This podcast is not a substitute for independent medical advice from a qualified professional.
While we endeavour to ensure that any and all information presented in our podcast is accurate, it should not be used as a substitute for medical advice from your doctor.
Please do not use any information presented in this podcast to prevent, treat, cure, or diagnose any medical condition or disease without consulting with a qualified and licensed health professional.
Hi, I'm Minuri, the president of the Pediatric Society.
And I'm Alina, the vice president of the Pediatric Society.
And we're PedSoc on a pod!
Each month, we'll be bringing you stories from real people in pediatrics,
case studies from the industry,
and so much more.
Hi guys, welcome back to PedSoc on a pod, the ultimate podcast for all things pediatrics. We are your hosts, Minuri
and Alina.
And today we are thrilled to be joined by Dr. Thomas Moss, a resident medical officer, aspiring pediatrician, and JMP alumni, all the way from Newcastle.
It must be so busy working as a resident, Dr. Thomas. Thanks for taking the time to come onto the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to both meet you guys and then have a good chat about pediatrics.
So a resident medical officer, or RMO, is a doctor that is 2 years postgraduate and has not yet specialised. But we've had a bit of confusion understanding what a resident is and what they exactly do. Can you please tell us a bit more about what you do?
Yeah, definitely. So it's confusing. It definitely is. There's about 100 different titles for the same job, unfortunately. So kind of the structuring of it that I've got in my head, at least, is you start off as a JMO. So that's a junior medical officer. So that's your first year out. And that's also referred to as an intern. And then in your second year out, you become a resident. So you finished your internship, but you're also still referred to as an RMO or a JMO still. And so you're still also referred to as a junior medical officer. And then from there, depending on your pathway, you can either become a registrar, you can go into SRMOing. So that's a senior resident medical officer. And that's going towards, you know, for example, becoming a CMO, so a career medical officer. Registrar is when you're more going towards different specialties, but different specialties have different roles. So surgery has different titles again than medical, and on it goes, unfortunately. Just to make it a little bit more confusing for everyone.
Yeah, that sounds pretty confusing, honestly. Also had a question. You mentioned like you can go from resident medical officer to career medical officer. Does that mean you, is that right?
So like I'm not 100% sure on what the, yeah. As it's not a pathway that I'm particularly looking at doing.
Yeah,
but I think you go into being like an SRMO and there's a couple of other titles before, and then a career medical officer is once you've reached a certain number of years postgraduate.
So then like you don't necessarily have to specialise in something?
So there's no actual need to specialise if that's not the pathway that you want, if life gets in the way, if you just rather have a more general approach to it. Yeah.
So then would you just be working in the ED or like just in a hospital?
So mostly in the hospital. I've come across most of them working in ED, but I do know that there's also roles where you can be a career medical officer on the ward.
I see. All right. So then as a JRMO, how like many hours do you work in a week?
It is very specialty and rotation dependent.
Right.
So some of them you do your contracted number of hours, which full time is 76 to 80 a fortnight, so about 40 a week. But some specialties or some rotations are much busier than others, so you end up doing a lot more hours.
Yes. All right. So then I'm guessing then intern year and JMO RMO year, you kind of rotate around different specialties.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
That depends, and like you can change locations based on that because you're here in Armidale for your pediatrics rotation. That's
right? Yeah, which definitely recommend. And that's not just because I've worked with Dr. Cotterill.
Yeah.
So in your internship, you do one ED term, one relief term, one medical term, one surgical term, and then a elective. But they'll select you, basically, your elective. And that's the requirements for getting from provisional registration, which you get at the end of your medical degree, you get general registration. And then in your resident year, there's different requirements based on different health networks. But in summary, you are much more able to do many, like multiple things. So for example, my rotations this year, I had my amazing term in Armidale as a resident in pediatrics. I'm currently in pediatric surgery at the John Hunter.
Yeah.
Then I move on to obs gynae and ED in Belmont. And then I finish off the year on relief. So relief is kind of when you're just filling in everyone else who goes on holidays or goes on to nights or evenings. Someone still has to do their day job.
Yeah.
So the relief fills in.
Wow, that seems pretty tough.
It's really fun.
Yeah, that's good, I guess.
Yeah. So let's continue with our classic med school interview question. So why did you choose medicine?
I took a little bit of a different path than I think most. I didn't want to go into medicine initially. I wanted to go into drug research.
Oh, wow.
I very much enjoyed that aspect of science and health. Slightly a jump to medicine. I thought medicine was a lot of work for not a lot of payoff. Not 100% sure that opinion has changed, but I'm here now. But I was doing some volunteer work in stroke rehab. And I was finding I was really enjoying that aspect of patient, like interaction with patients or clients at the time, and was really enjoying that. So I thought I'd say, give it a go and see. And the job security is a lot better in medicine than in research. So that's also nice. But medicine's really good in the way that in the future, I still hope to do some drug research or to go into different pathways. It's not all clinical medicine. There's many different opportunities and pathways for medicine, which is lovely. Yeah,
that's true. I really appreciate the flexibility that you can get in medicine. Then what made you change from having that initial interest in stroke rehab and that's how you kind of got interested in med to wanting to do pediatrics, which is kind of different?
Very different.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed the patient interaction in stroke rehab, but I didn't love adult medicine. I've always loved kids and being with kids. I'm the eldest of the grandchildren on my mom's side, so always been surrounded by children. And then in my end of first year in the summer break, when I went back home, picked up a job looking after this child with Wolf-Hirschhorn syndrome, which is a real unique genetic syndrome.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Which I've never come across except for looking after this guy, and I adored him. He was so much fun to be with, and I really enjoyed doing all the realistically more allied health approach, but doing his physio, just interacting with him, seeing the interaction between his family, him, and the different strains that it puts on the family of having a child that experiences disability. So I really enjoyed that. And ever since then, I just enjoyed pediatrics more. Every time I'm doing learning in regards to that, it sticks better in my head. I find myself enjoying it more. And then even just working in it, I love medicine. I love going to work each day. There's some days I love it more than others.
Yeah.
But I find that in general, whenever I've been on a rotation with children involved, I've just enjoyed the day so much more.
I understand there's like an emotional burden with working with children as well, because I feel like kids don't really have a choice in what happens to them. Like sometimes a lot of adult medicine people tend to have like self-inflicted kind of conditions, like for example smoking can cause a lot of cancers and stuff. So how do you kind of balance like caring for this child but not getting too emotionally overwhelmed when you work?
I think it's a very difficult thing, but balancing the innate, you want to help and care for every single person that you come across, but also, you're a person as well. And I think a lot of it is relying on your support networks. I know it's a term they throw around a lot, but having people both professionally and personally that you can talk to and kind of decompress after each difficult experience is really important. And actually, we've mentioned Dr. Cotterill a couple of times already, but one of my best days in pediatrics was when I was in fourth year and I arrived to the day, probably on time, I'm sure. And Dr. Cotterill was on call all night and was on call that day as well. and she'd been called in like twice already that night, and a child was born that had, was very unwell, so it was in special care nursery at the time. And over that day, we had two more children, I think, that were born with different things that all required special care nursery. And we also had two of those children end up being retrieved by helicopter and taken down to the John Hunter for more detailed care. It was a crazy day. It was insanity. We didn't, and that, as a student, we did not, like, I did not stop the whole day. And so I can only imagine what it would have been like for Dr. Cottrell after being up all night as well. But then at the end of it, she still went, all right, this is like at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. She's been on for God knows how many hours, but too many. She takes us all into a side room and spends the next half an hour, talking us through what happened that day.
Yeah.
Trying to elicit whether we're, okay. And just decompressing after it all. And she managed to get biscuits. I don't know where they came from, but somehow she managed to get biscuits, which were the greatest biscuits you've ever had when you haven't eaten in, 8 hours.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was an incredible day. And obviously I'm quite biased that I think Dr. Cottrell's a very good doctor, but also a very good person to work with.
Oh my gosh, that sounds so overwhelming. And I'm a bit more excited to start my placements in fourth year in a couple of years as well.
Yeah.
Speaking about being a JMP alumni, I'm guessing your time in the program was good from what you've said so far, but are there any key experiences that you had here that you want to share with us?
Well, that one definitely takes the cake. That was definitely the best day I had as a student from a learning point of view. I really enjoyed my time, especially at UNE. I mean, there's definitely aspects of it that aren't as good, and there's aspects of it that are really good. And you kind of got to look at it all overall and what ends up you coming out the other end. And overall, I feel like, overall it prepared me well, and the whole time I've enjoyed medicine. So, it didn't beat that joy out of me. So can't complain too much.
Yeah.
That's really good to hear. We're glad you enjoyed your time here in Armidale, and we also can't wait to see what's next for us.
And so we'll just move on to what we wanted to talk about for this podcast today then. Right now, me and Alina are in the middle of our neurology block, so we're learning a lot about traumatic brain injuries like seizures and strokes. And this week we kind of covered the more degenerative conditions like dementia. But we're not going to discuss all of that today because I feel like that's going to be a really long talk then. But one thing that we were really interested in that we saw was shaken baby syndrome, especially because it is pediatrics related.
Yeah, so with shaken baby syndrome, we actually came across this during our anatomy labs because our professor was talking about pediatric related traumatic brain injuries.
And so shaken baby syndrome, as it says in the name, is a type of brain injury that happens when a baby or a young child is shaken violently. Are we saying that right, Thomas?
Yeah. It's an injury that's based on repetitive motions of flexion, extension, rotation of the head in a smaller child where, they don't have the neck strength to support themselves, and the forces acting on it are quite high in comparison to the size of their bodies.
Yeah, I've seen that this mostly happens in children under 2, but it can be seen in children up to 5 years old. According to data from 2022, which is not too recent, but in the US, it is the most common cause of child abuse in child abuse related death in children under 5. And in Australia, there's about 29 cases of this per 100,000 hospital admissions in children under 2. So we found that this is actually more frequent than drowning. Have you actually seen a case like this come into the hospital before?
No, I luckily have never come across a case of shaken baby syndrome. However, unfortunately, I have come across multiple incidences of, I'm going to say likely physical child abuse, which is always really hard to see as someone who, everyone in pediatrics, I think, enjoys and loves kids, so seeing them harmed is especially difficult. I also find it very interesting that no matter the environment that the child is brought up in. You know, you have this picture of child abuse happening in, you know, families of single families, low SES, you know, drugs and alcohol being involved. And whilst, yes, there are definitely risk factors for it, it can still happen to anyone, that, you know, any kind of family structure. So, you know, it's always an important differential to kind of have in the back of your mind when you see suspicious injuries or inconsistent history.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I mean, most people in pediatrics would be passionate about children. So seeing like these presentations would be quite upsetting as well. So thank you for sharing your experience in that. Another reason why we wanted to talk about this condition today is because of a video circulating around Instagram, where in the videos we see a dad swinging his baby around doing stunts, like in acrobatics or cheerleading. So swinging the baby by the arms back and forth over his head, between his legs.
And like a lot of people were online, were of course concerned about this potentially leading to like trauma, whether he like dislocates the baby's elbow or like maybe induced shaken baby syndrome.
Yeah, so what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I hadn't come across the video until you guys had sent it to me. So it was quite shocking. I had one expectation of what it was going to show, and it almost looked rehearsed,
yeah,
the actual behavior. But yeah, it's a good demonstration again of, you know, the atypicalness of child abuse and harm that can happen to children. You know, I like to believe that there wasn't a nefarious intent behind that. It looked like he, you know, was trying to play with the child, you know, and
yeah,
enjoy the child in itself. But, you know, it comes down to a lack of understanding in regards to the anatomy and the unique anatomy and physiology of young children and infants especially. And, you know, to kind of reference that fun quote you had in regards to drownings, in relation to abusive head trauma, I find that I've come across a lot more information, just not even from a medical standpoint, in regards to drownings and water safety in children. But you don't see nearly as much. Maybe that's just, you know, my current age and, you know, demographics in which the circles I run in. But you don't see very much about abusive head traumas outside of wear a helmet when you go riding a bike, for example.
Yeah, that's true. I feel like a lot of the times when something like this happens, it's often not intentional. So it must be like traumatic on the family as well, because you don't really expect having fun with a child like this could lead to something serious in the long term. Because this condition can be fatal, because like even with immediate medical attention, these babies can survive, but some of them often have long-term consequences and effects as they grow up. Do you know any actual effects that could happen when these children grow up?
Yeah, so when they grow up, obviously, there's a wide variety, and it's based on what injuries they've had. So you can get things from very mild learning disabilities to real significant severe cognitive and physical issues. So, you know, attention deficits, developmental delays, intellectual losses. You can also get some real severe, you know, more obvious, I'm going to say, you know, people have gone completely blind from it. You can become seizure disorders, motor dysfunction, and hearing impairments. Because it's an injury to the brain, completely depends on where the injury and what structures are damaged due to the injury.
That makes sense. Thank you for explaining that so well.
It's also unfortunate because children who have, you know, all of these different long effects, one of the risk factors for child abuse is children with disabilities. So the first incidences of having it can therefore increase the risk of future child abuse situations, which is really unfortunate for the child, obviously, but
yeah,
it's kind of a self-perpetuating cycle.
That is pretty rough, honestly.
Yeah, so another question we had is, can shaken baby syndrome be self-induced? So if a baby hits their own head, especially when they're trying to sit up and they like fall backwards a little, or if something accidentally falls on their head, can that induce shaken baby syndrome?
Those two mechanisms that you've just described, I would say no. But children can have significant traumas from, you know, activities that they can be going. However, surprisingly, rates of head traumas and like head injuries themselves in children are a lot lower than you would think from different things. So one example is on PEDS trauma, PEDS search, you see a lot of traumas. And we had a child recently that fell 4 meters over a balcony and fell onto tiles. And so this child was probably about two, three, and wasn't physical. Like, we don't suspect any child abuse or anything like that. But the only injuries that it ended up having was a badly fractured humerus and a graze on its head. So completely neurologically intact, no intracranial bleeds. There was no suspicions of any concussion or anything while during its admission. Whilst, yes, it can happen, it also happens at a lot lower rate than, you know, one would think.
That's actually really nice to hear that, especially because I feel like babies tend to be quite delicate to people, babies. So, like, it's hard to, like, handle them, especially when you're younger and you don't really know what to do with a baby. So I guess shaken baby syndrome and, like, more pediatric-related head injuries have to be caused by a little bit more, like, violent or, like, intense situations. Is that right?
Yeah, but it also depends on the age. So, you know, as a child gets older and more developmentally mature, you build up that neck structure. You build up the strength in your neck and that. Also, even just the where the neck bends changes as you get older. So when you're a newborn or child, the actual flexion injuries often happen around C1, C2, so right up in the base of the skull. Whereas as you get older, can't remember the number for adults, but I want to say C7, 8 is the flexion point. Yeah. But again, don't quote me on that. Just edit that one out if it's wrong.
And concussions are also quite common. So, and like since it's not, is that also classified as like a head injury or is it like a milder form of like, I'm not too sure how to describe it actually. So what would like differentiate having like a mild concussion compared to like, I don't know, something more severe related to the brain?
So like in comparison to like shaken baby syndrome. So shaken baby syndrome is kind of like a collection of signs and symptoms associated with a mechanism of injury, which is the shaking portion, whereas a concussion is basically a mild head or brain injury that occurs due to a trauma or a head insult, which that could be shaken baby syndrome, that could be falling off a bed, it could be crashing a bike. So kind of that's how I would think about it, is, you know, one's a collection of symptoms, whereas one's a, that's what happens as a result of.
Yeah. And so what are some red flags that you can like look out for that differentiates concussion from shaken baby syndrome?
Yeah. So I suppose the kind of things that I'd be looking for if I was suspecting like a child abuse kind of picture or, you know, would be an inconsistent history between, you know, mum, dad, friends, family, whoever's, you know, carers have brought in the child, if, you know, their stories aren't quite lining up. Another big one is delayed presentation. So if a child, you know, if the story you're hearing is the child fell from 2 meters, you know, bunk bed or something, and they've come in 6 hours later, well, typically a parent or a carer would bring that child in very quickly. You know, they'd be in straight away, called an ambulance out of concern for the child. But often in, you know, in child abuse, they hope the child will just get better, rather than coming in straight away and getting the child checked out. Other big ones to look out for is injuries that don't match the mechanism of injury. You know, it's very rare for a child that's not, you know, under 4 months, they're not moving around, like walking, they're not coasting around on furniture. So having bruises would be a real big red flag. Why is this child having injuries? Or, you know, even when they are moving around and, you know, furniture cruising, it's very odd to have abdominal bruises or from there, because, you know, the mechanism of falling over. Sure, hands and arms make sense, but where's an abdominal injury? It's much more rarer. So suspicious injuries that are atypical for a child's age or development. Kind of the big red flags that I'd be looking for.
All right. Thank you so much for sharing those important things to keep in mind of.
Are there any preventative measures parents can take to reduce the risk of shaken baby syndrome?
Yeah, well, I think the big ones, you know, both from the parent side, but also from the healthcare side, is education and support. It's really the mainstays of avoiding something that is caused by us, you know, errors. So, you know, education, you know, for the example of the dad, safe play, you know, what we would want to see with someone who's, you know, we still want kids to have fun. We still want parents to be involved in playing with children. Can't wrap them all in cotton wool, but, you know, safer play than throwing a child around. And, you know, another often cause of shaken baby syndrome is, you know, the crying. You know, a child who's unwell or not feeling well, they'll cry. They'll cry lots. And that can be really stressful for a parent who, you know, has just gone through birth, has, you know, it's not had much sleep, potentially not enough supports in their lives. So educating them on managing those stressful and difficult situations, teaching them where they can reach out to provide support, and, you know, ideally trying to build that support network around them so that they, you know, reach out and go, oh, look, friend, please come and look after and keep an eye on my child whilst I get 4 hours sleep unbroken. You know, it can be a really big, important thing. And then from a healthcare point of view, identifying those high-risk patients, you know, the single parents, low SES, you know, drug and alcohol history, and then providing extra supports and linking them in with community programs that can help assist them and therefore prevent any child abuse situations occurring.
Thank you so much for your insight in kind of preventing this condition. We'll just segue into more like pediatric head injuries in general. Do you see a lot of, you said that during your pediatric surgery rotation, you do see a lot of trauma cases. Were head injuries a big part of that, or was it more like fractures and sick kids?
Yeah, how the structure at the John works, at least, is all traumas for children come under pediatric surgery, and then we consult and have, you know, if there's a fracture, orthopedics come and review and manage that aspect of it. So we see a lot of traumas and a lot of fractures are involved in that care. But an important part of ped surge is ruling out and like having a decision around whether investigations for head injuries are required. And so, yes, they are quite common. I curse e-bikes with a passion, the amount of e-scooters that people don't wear helmets with and come off is way too high at the moment. So yes, wear your helmets, kids. I'm sure there's plenty of kids that are listening to this. So there's a lot that we actually do in regards to head injuries, and there's quite a structure in regards to primary surveys, secondary surveys, and tertiary surveys. And then for older children, there's also like Oloptuses, and there's a PBIRT team, which is kind of a team of allied health, but also pediatricians that typically are neurologists trained, and they're juniors that look into and help manage not just the acute hospital stay of head injuries, but also ongoing. So whether they've just gotten a concussion versus if they've got, you know, ongoing brain injury, they help support them going forwards into the community as well.
Just in relation to what you actually, well, we learnt in PBLs and stuff that we, for like an adult coming in with a trauma, like head injury kind of presentation, we use like the GCS and the mini mental state exam. Is that like the same thing that you guys use for babies and like children, or is it a little bit modified?
Yeah. there still is a, like GCS can still be used. However, there's a pediatric version of it. But there's other techniques you can use as well. So I think it's called the PREDICT algorithm is a great algorithm for, and it works through the mechanism of injury, the symptoms that the child has, and then allows you to risk stratify based on different comorbidities, bleeding disorders. I think it's got a caveat for Down syndrome, for example, as well. And that algorithm helps with determining whether you want to do, whether it's indicated to do a CT in that child. Because obviously lots of children bump their heads. They're running around, fall over and bump their head. Not every child needs a CT. We try to avoid too many CTs. So having that kind of structuring helps with risk stratifying these children and then CTing the ones that need to be CTed. So you can rule out or treat any sequelae of injury versus the children that just need reassurance and then education for the red flags for their parent to bring them back in, parent or carer.
Thank you for sharing. That was very insightful. So pediatric head injuries can have serious consequences, but with awareness and proactive measures, we can strive to keep our children safe and healthy.
So we'll just move on to a little bit more about yourself, I guess. In your 2 years as a doctor, what was the most interesting case that you came across? Or was there like a recent case that was quite challenging to approach or manage?
In regards to pediatrics, it's a little difficult because they're also recent. So de-identifying patients is a bit harder.
Yep.
But I think the most interesting cases that I'd come across was, as I'd already mentioned, that day with Dr. Cotterill in special care nursery at Armidale, just seeing the wide variety of different presentations from a child that had a condition where the connective protein between layers of the skin wasn't present. So when you touch them, their skin would just slide off, to having a child born with from a diabetic mother that then went hypoglycemic and needed management there. It's some really incredible experiences. I do very much recommend a rotation in Armidale. It's a very good one.
Just going back to that child with the skin that slid off, can you tell us a bit more about that? Because I don't think we've ever heard about something like that happening before.
I always struggle with remembering the name of the condition, but it's a genetic condition that can often arise from, without any known history of it from the family, but they can be carriers for it. And then it can also, there's different penetrance of that condition. So some of them have, quite a severe disease, whereas others, it takes a lot more trauma. So it's almost on a spectrum of how much trauma needs to happen to the skin before it peels off or falls away.
Oh, so what would be like, it would be a long-term thing that they would have to deal with as they grow up. What would be some sort of management strategy for the child to like not always be like suffering? Because I believe it must be like painful for like skin to kind of peel off because it is like a protective barrier. So would they also like be more prone to infections and stuff because they don't have that physical barrier on their skin?
Yeah. So every time their skin broke, there would be a risk of infection. So it's around a lot of wound care. And there is a specialty purely just based on managing these children that I think is run out of Westmead. I'm not 100% sure. It might be Randwick. And so they'd be in contact with the CNC. So there's some nurses that are trained specifically for this and the doctors there to help support them. And it would depend based on the child. So on one end of the spectrum, you can't use Band-Aids or plasters. Clothes have to be turned inside out because of the where the stitching is, the fold there, just that rubbing against the skin can cause it to tear.
Oh, wow.
But then other ones could live quite normal lives with just higher, lower amounts of force or like shearing. causing an injury.
Sounds very interesting. Thank you for sharing, Thomas. It's so interesting to hear about the variety of cases that you see in a hospital setting, even like really rare ones as well that like I've never heard of.
Do you actually see a lot of like rare cases when you like work? Like, is it mostly like the same kind of case that is rare, or is it like a variety of different conditions that you see? Do you kind of get what I'm...
Yeah, you see the common things commonly, and the rare things rarely. But because when you start narrowing down into a subspecialty, you see the rarer stuff more common because, you know, simple cases get managed by GPs, ED doctors. So you've got to go through multiple layers of healthcare before you reach, you know, your specialties and your subspecialties. So you see the rarer things more often, but seeing an individual rare thing is very rare, but seeing a rare thing is quite common, if that makes sense. If you're looking just for a single rare condition, you could be waiting a long time.
But then, speaking of subspecialties, do you have one in mind that you want to do as a pediatrician?
I am very open to most things. The two kind of areas I'm looking in more specifically are mostly based on my experiences in adult medicine, because obviously in your internship, you can't do pediatrics in New South Wales. You have to wait until you're a resident before you get to do a rotation in it.
Wow, okay.
So your exposure is a lot lower. So as a result, I've done a fair bit more adult medicine than kids at this point. But the areas I really enjoyed in adult medicine, and I want to see how that corresponds with children, is gastroenterology. Really enjoyed that. And palliative care. Those are the kind of two areas that I'm looking at. And then, you know, I think I'd also be very happy with general pediatrics as a specialty. So open to most things, though.
Oh, thank you for sharing that, Thomas. That's like, I don't know, I'm not quite sure on where in pediatrics I really want to specialize in. So this was like a really good way to kind of scope out and see what people are interested in and what made them want to do pediatrics, especially because I don't think I knew about the variety of subspecialties within the specialty that you can get. So thank you so much for that.
Oh, and quite frankly, I've only recently come to that kind of realization, because when you start medicine, it starts as medicine.
Yeah.
And then you slowly learn all the subspecialties, and then you realize inside of each subspecialty, there's specialties inside of that. And then, you know, you start adding in people's special interest areas, and you can become very, very sub-sub-specialized. But definitely keep your mind open. And yeah, you guys have identified pediatrics as something that's interesting so early on. That's great. Shockingly, I think pediatrics is good. So,
and like, how long do you think it would take you to finish specializing? Because I know as a doctor, you'd never really stop studying. It's like definitely a part of your life as you continue. But I know there's like, once you specialize, you do like your fellowship, and then do you eventually end up as some sort of consultant, or is that just depending on the specialty?
Yeah, it is a little bit dependent on specialty and what, you know, subspecialty, if you go into that as well. So the kind of the rough structure of it is, life doesn't get in the way, or you don't end up doing something else for a little bit, is minimum you've got to have 2 years of experience after you've graduated, and then you can apply to be the PEDS basic physician training, basically. And at the end, during those 3 years, you do a big exam. And I know the exams will never end.
No, never.
Which is broken up into like a written portion and a, you know, more physical exam, history orientated way. And then after that, you go into what's called AT training. And so that's where you choose your sub-subspecialty kind of, or you apply for it more realistically. And one of those is general pediatrics. But you can also do, you know, gastroenterology, neurology, 100 different things. And you can do two as well, you know, extend your training, obviously, but you can do them. And then after that, you know, you've got your letters per se. So you could work as a consultant so as a specialist, but you can also do fellowships. So that's kind of where you get some more experience working in just a single subspecialty with special interest kind of area. And they, from what I'm seeing, are becoming more and more common that people are doing a fellowship, especially in some specialties of medicine and surgery, but more and more it's becoming a thing you do.
Thank you so much for sharing that, because we're always like wanting to learn more about how to actually like the next steps on after you become a doctor, because like you said, when you first try to get into medicine, it's a very like, oh, it's medicine, that's it.
Yeah.
And then once you like go through the years, you're just like wondering where you want to end up. So thank you so much for that.
Oh, look, and realistically, I'm still learning all of the different things that you can do. And I mean, I'm going to be going to an information session in a month or two on applying to go into pediatrics. So I'm sure in a couple of months, I'll know a lot more and look back at this conversation and be like, oh, I left out this. I said this wrong. So always learning. That's for sure.
And I guess we'll wrap up our episode for today here. Yeah.
Just one last thing. Do you have any tips for any aspiring medical students like in Armidale or even us as medical students in like our medical journey?
Yeah. What would I say? I think the most important thing is to enjoy it. Like, it is a very long journey with some very, very difficult times. So trying to enjoy it as much as you can. You know, reach out to people that you find inspirational and try and, you know, see if they have any opportunities that you can get involved with, you know, especially, you know, you guys with special interest in pediatrics. You're very lucky. You've got Dr. Cotterill just around the corner that you can always talk to.
Yeah.
But even when you're on placement, if you've, you know, come across someone, whether it's registrar, junior or consultant that you get along with, well, just reach out to them, find out what their lives are like so you can kind of, you know, see what the future looks like for you. But also, you know, prepare for said future.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for that, Thomas. I guess we'll wrap up the episode now. Thank you so much for taking the time to come onto our show. We know that you're very busy, but we both enjoy learning all about all of this from you.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
If you enjoyed today's episode, please be sure to subscribe to our podcast for pediatrics-related content. We'd love to hear your thoughts, so please leave us a review or connect with us on social media at UNEPedSoc on Instagram.
And before we wrap up, we would also like to give a huge shout out to Ash and Ben here at TuneFM for their continuous support and coming to the studio after hours to help make this podcast possible.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed our talk and we can't wait to come back with another episode next month. See you then.
Thanks for listening this month on PedSoc on a Pod on TuneFM.
You can catch any episodes you've missed on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Don't forget to follow us on social media at UNEPedSoc to stay up to date with the Pediatric Society's news and events.